Welcome to El Paso Primetime. Information for everyone, especially those who live in the third age.
This is the town and these are the people. This is the town where the people all stay. This is the town and these are the people. That's the way they wanted it. That's the way it's going to stay.
Welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. I'm Dennis Wu, and we're talking all kinds of things about elder law. This is second in a series of shows, and with me are basically the whole staff of Townsend Ayala & Associates. Stephanie Townsend Ayala's here, Jennifer Coulter's here, Jessica Clute is here, and we've been talking about elder law and everything that pertains to you. Yes, you there with the face pointing at yourself saying, me? Yes, you. Because let's face it, tomorrow is not guaranteed to you. It's not guaranteed to me. None of us. And you have to plan for the future. So, ladies, welcome back again to El Paso Primetime.
Thanks for having us. We're excited to come back.
Let's talk about, last time we had barely touched on something that you had mentioned, Jessica, about the VA. So, Jennifer, I want to talk to you about the VA. And let me give you a scenario. Korea War veteran, for the most part, has been incapacitated in a wheelchair for the most part. Family's been taking care of this gentleman for the longest time. He's been at home and is finally getting to a point where he now needs assisted living but doesn't have long-term health insurance. VA's been taking care of him up until just a few weeks ago, and now it's really necessary to take care of this person. There is a will. And the kids are involved in it. Two of them are, a brother and sister. And then there's the third one, a granddaughter, who's now been written into the will. And actually, there are three granddaughters. Okay, so there you go. So there's two kids, three granddaughters. Everybody gets to split the estate and everything. But this guy now has to go to assisted living, but doesn't have any protection, shall we say. What happens at this point?
Okay, so this is a complicated situation. There may be multiple elements at play. So we want to start with being sure that he's got a power of attorney, durable for the finances and medical for the medical decisions. If he doesn't have those in place already, we're going to want to talk to his doctor to see if, when you said he's incapacitated, that means that he can't understand decision making. If he can't, we may end up having to send him to Jessica here to do a guardianship so that one of the kids can have the legal authority to handle his finances and make those benefits applications that he's going to need. But as long as we've got somebody with legal authority or he's got the ability to give it to somebody, then we start looking at benefits. There's a couple of possibilities for him. As a Korean War veteran, if he served during the wartime, he was honorably discharged, he might be able to get some benefits through the VA. We have improved pensions for wartime veterans. There's three of them, including aid and attendance and homebound vets. Those can provide a cash benefit to a veteran who served during wartime and was honorably discharged, whose income and resources aren't sufficient for his needs. This is a means-tested program, but it's means-tested in a way that some of the other programs aren't. They look at his income and they say, look, if his income is being consumed by his medical needs, he may need some extra help. So in an assisted living setting, he may be able to use his income and those kinds of improved pensions through the VA to pay for his care. If he's able to get that benefit and it's sufficient for his needs, then from there he can be good. He makes that application with the VA and he moves forward. He'd want to come to us or have the kids come to us just to be sure that he's within all of the right ranges and to make sure that we're structuring those assets properly. But a lot of the problems that we've had with VA benefits have been a result of only planning for VA benefits. The VA benefits have not had transfer penalties, so I could take $1 million and give them to my kids and be okay for VA purposes. But then if I need to go to a skilled nursing facility where you're looking at between About 4,500 and 7,000 a month in El Paso for skilled nursing care. Most people's income plus their VA improved pension is not sufficient to cover that, and then they need long-term care Medicaid benefits. In that case, transfer penalties. So we don't want to make gifts outright. There's a lot of planning that can be done in that case to make sure that he's getting all of the benefits that he needs while still protecting as much as possible for himself and then for the kids after he passes away.
Okay. You know, and it is a very complicated sort of a situation because, granted, okay, so the scenario is there. But that scenario can change from day to day.
Well, and I wanted to address the part about the kids and the grandkids because she addressed about him.
Mm-hmm.
So what we would do, let's say he's got $100,000 cash in the bank. He has a home outright and almost nothing else and just his income, his VA income.
Right.
Let's say. And so what we can do is say, okay, you under the Medicaid guidelines, you cannot – get Medicaid if you're a single person and you have more than $2,000 in the bank. However, you can do a lot of things with that $100,000 and then get Medicaid the next month. For example, you could use that money to make improvements on the home to maybe get a new roof, new flooring, whatever needs
make
to be done.
Make it wheelchair accessible.
You can make it
prepay the property taxes, utilities,
exactly.
Homeowners insurance.
You could buy a car of any value and one of those two kids or one of the grandkids could drive it and they could use it to take the veteran to his medical appointments. They could use it to take him out places that, you know, his money could be used to buy a vehicle of just about any value that makes it easy for his loved ones to travel around. And then his loved ones can benefit from having the use of that car.
Okay.
And so there, and plus he could take his money and put it into he could take that entire lump sum and put it into an education fund for his two grandchildren, as long as they're 21 or under, and then the next month qualify for Medicaid. So when you hear about these, what I'm talking about and these rules all emanate from a bill that was passed by Congress in 1993 called OBRA 93. It was the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1993. And it said, if you work your 40 quarters in Social Security, if you qualify, if you're a hardworking middle-class American, working-class American, and you need nursing care before you die, we'll cover the difference between your income and the cost of your care. Almost no matter what your income is, I have had people who have a $5,000 a month income, but the nursing home costs $9,000 a month, so we got Medicaid to cover the difference. I've had people who have all kinds of situations, and all of these rules emanate again from OBRA 93. Start thinking about, and when you think about it, it's good public policy. It's good social policy. The reasons that they let you get a car because it helps you transport your loved one. That's simple stuff and keeps them off public benefits for those things. If you help to educate, if you let them put money to educate your grandkids or your great-grandkids, that is great social policy. That's good public policy. You know, we're not letting millionaires get Medicaid. No. What we're doing is we're helping the middle-class, working-class American citizens or citizens of El Paso County, at least, and in Texas, get the benefits they need to cover their care without having to become completely impoverished and put your loved ones on food stamps because of it, because you go to a nursing home.
And when she talks about that $2,000 resource limitation, that's for a single person. For a married couple, we can protect a lot more. Depending on the married couple themselves, the minimum is about $25,000 and the maximum about $119,000. But if the couple's income is very low, we can protect a lot more sometimes, enough so that that spouse who stays home doesn't need to get government benefits herself. That's the public policy behind that. They say we want a community spouse, the spouse who's healthy and well. We want her to be able to afford to live in the community, to be able to continue going about her life, to pay for the property taxes and homeowners insurance and all of those things. without needing to get assistance through the government. So we'll let her protect enough to be able to live in the community. So for married couples, we have better planning opportunities if we're doing it in crisis management. If we're doing it in pre-planning, we can do some much better things so that we're able to protect a lot so that the spouses don't have to be in the position. What I see a lot is the kids come to me. The kids are my clients. They come to me and they say, my dad is homebound. He's in a wheelchair. The kids in your scenario would come to me and say, and we have been coming up with out of our pocket the money to pay for him to be in the assisted living place, but we just can't come up with $4,000 a month anymore, which I understand. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money for the kids to have to come up with out of pocket. And I see a lot of the kids rating their 401ks, rating their retirement savings, rating their home buying
their
funds
kids education
their
funds.
Kids' education funds to pay for care that their parents could be getting assistance if they had a little help getting through that benefits thorn
mm-hmm. in the
days.
Well, in Texas, it's difficult. It's not as hard in New Mexico because they have a different philosophy. Mm-hmm. But in Texas, it's gotten to the point where you need an attorney just to access these types of Medicaid benefits for home health care. It's called Star Plus, or for a nursing home, which is SNF. It's LTC SNF, SNF, Long-Term Care Skilled Nursing Facility. So those are the two types of Medicaid that are really for the working class. Most El Pasoans can qualify for them. Mm-hmm. Most El Pasoans, if you don't qualify right now, if you hire an attorney, you can qualify. And there's a lot of useful tools we use to help people move forward. But as Jenny was saying earlier, some people don't want to get the benefits. They're afraid of losing their home. They're afraid. There's a myth and there's a thought that if you access Medicaid benefits that the state of Texas is going to come take your home. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true. Now, there's a possibility of it. And the state, they make it sound like everyone's going to lose their home.
Sure.
Yeah, they to make it easier with air quotes, mm-hmm. They have a new easier to use application form for SNF and for Star Plus, and it went from 12 pages to 26 pages. And like the first 5 pages are, we're going to take your home. We're going to take your home. We're going to take your home. Sign right here so that we can take your home. When in fact, it doesn't even apply to the vast majority of citizens. None of our clients have ever lost a home. And so what you need to do is inform yourself. What are your rights? And when the state of Texas wrongfully denies 75% of applicants for these types of programs are wrongfully denied. They could be easily fixed with one little thing, one issue here or there. And people walk away after being mm-hmm. denied Medicaid benefits thinking they'll never qualify. And that is absolutely not true. If you are denied long-term care Medicaid benefits, go see an attorney, because there are always ways to get around that. There are so many ways. And there's a 5,000-page Medicaid handbook. We are familiar with every single page. So what they'll do, the state will say, you don't qualify based on Section 4600. Well, people don't understand what 4600 means, and they don't understand that if they just would do one little thing or get one piece of paper, they could qualify. Mm-hmm. The state's not allowed to tell them that. Texas mm-hmm. makes it to where caseworkers are barred from helping people. They can only tell you—
They're barred from giving legal advice, which often means from helping people. They try to help
True.
As best they
True.
Can, but they have to
Thank
say
you, Jen.
You're ineligible because you're over the income limitation. And then they are prevented by their rules and by the people who make policy for them from saying, but there's absolutely a super easy fix for that.
Also, I mean, honestly, I believe that they themselves have the misconceptions about the programs themselves. So the people that are giving the information have misinformation as their belief system. So it's not, you know, you need that. I tell my clients, I know you really believe what your bank teller told you, but please take the advice only within our walls. You know, what they might say might have a kernel of truth or be one brick in the wall, but it fails to see the entire picture.
Right.
You know,
I had a caseworker for Texas State Medicaid Dads Department of Aging and Disability Services mm-hmm. tell a prospective client that she was going to have to sell her wedding ring before she could get Medicaid benefits.
What?
And that she'd have to sell her china.
Which is absolutely
untrue. I mean,
it's untrue.
Just outrageous misconceptions and myths out there.
Well, why would anybody from the state even tell someone
Good
that?
Question.
There's 5,000 pages of handbook, and it's – when I very first started doing this, I sat down. I knew I wanted to do the benefits counseling. I knew I wanted to help people get Medicaid benefits.
Mm-hmm.
I sat down and I started to read the handbook on how to protect resources or how to determine what was protectable for a spouse. I spent an entire afternoon reading it, got done, and thought, I have no idea what any of that said. And I'm a lawyer.
And
I'm
she's
trained
really
to
smart.
Read statutes. And
right.
I am reasonably intelligent. I called another attorney, the guy who writes our practice guide in this field. His name is Clyde Farrell. He's out of Austin. I called him up and I said, Clyde, I just read this. I do not understand anything that they just said. And he explained it to me and I thought, maybe. And I got off the phone with him and I reread it and I thought, yeah, I could see that that's what they're possibly trying to get at. We're asking caseworkers who only know about that one level of handbook to interpret that plus the statutes at the Texas level creating those rules plus the level of the Code of Federal Regulations plus the initial enabling statutes that they've never even heard of. We're asking caseworkers to interpret these things in many cases. They're being asked – they're being told in their mandate, do not give legal advice. Now apply these legal rules and tell people what they should be doing here.
Right.
It's a very difficult job that we're asking them to do, and they do it much underpaid and much overworked. Their caseloads are very heavy. They don't always get as much training as they should have, and they have a reasonably high turnover rate. So there's a lot of new people on a pretty regular basis. Most of them are working very hard to get benefits for people who are eligible for them. The rest of them are working very hard not to get benefits for people who aren't eligible. And while both of those things are perfectly fine ways of approaching it, you're going to get a lot of wrongful denials for people who are trying not to get benefits to people. So they're trying. Most of them are trying very hard, but we're asking them to do a job that's practically impossible on very little salary and right. very heavy caseloads.
And Texas ranks 51st out of 50 states. We are the absolute worst in terms of the way we run our program. Not a big surprise. So we have mandates. Sometimes – one time there was a mandate that lasted all of 6 months when the state said, well, we're not going to let anybody supplement. Nobody's going to be allowed to supplement their application. So if you don't have – if there's a document that somebody determines they need later on, you're not allowed to give it to us. We're just going to deny everybody who doesn't have a complete packet. So for about 6 months, all of our cases were – everything was going – having to go to appeal. And it was so overwhelming, they had to stop it eventually. So they don't – I don't think people understand that these – administrators we have, executives running these programs, they can issue mandates. Mm. It doesn't come from the legislature. They can just decide one day, this is how we're going to treat people. And then the legislature doesn't find out about it until 6 months later or something, and they only meet every 2 years, so they can't even do anything about
it. And I mean, if you're looking at as an administrator of a business, they're going to look at cutting costs and trying to be efficient when efficiency may not be the best way to achieve the goals there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now that all of that is out on the table, then, you know, I can see the listener at home thinking, well, what the hell am I going to do? Well, it starts with you in case you don't have a will to get a will.
And that your powers starts of with attorney.
That. Yeah, and mm-hmm. then powers of attorney. Yeah, it makes sense. And which goes right back to the original conversation last show around about people having these misconceptions that we just have to knock down. And one of them is all about the will.
Mm-hmm.
And the first question that I would put out there is, how detailed should a will be?
Oh, this is a fun one. This is Jen's pet peeve, so we'll let her do it.
I talk to lawyers every time I can corner them. And ask them, do you do estate planning? And I hear them often say, I don't do estate planning, but I'll do a simple will. And I want to shake them until they stop doing that. because there's no such thing as a simple will. What they're talking about is what you might call an I love you will. To my beloved wife, if she survives me, if not, to our kids. All the kids are kids of the marriage. They've been married for 60 years. They just have their stuff they want to pass to each other. That is about as simple a situation as you can end up in. The problem with that is, what if we have husband die and he gives all of his assets to wife and now she's a single person for Medicaid purposes and now he gave her a whole bunch of stuff outright that if he had put it in a trust in his will for her, it could have all been protected so that she would have an ability to buy stuff to make herself happy if she needs Medicaid. What if those kids who are perfectly fine and healthy when we write that simple will, what if one of them becomes disabled? Somebody like me who was, I was perfectly fine and healthy, and then when I was 22, I had a 7-inch blood clot in my brain and went blind. I spent several years on government benefits while I learned how to be blind and went to school and got my legal degree. Until I got back to work as a lawyer, I was on disability benefits. So what happens if somebody who was in perfectly good health when you wrote the will becomes disabled? What if that person dies and we leave stuff to their minor children and now we've given gifts to the kid, to the underage kids? What if the people are in bankruptcy, in divorce proceedings when the person dies? So we want a will that's going to really cover all of the scenarios. The problem with saying –
and that does not even cover all of the ones that we will cover in our basic ones.
When we say it's a simple will, what we mean is the situation right now, today, in my office is relatively simple. The problem with that is wills don't become effective today, right now, when you're in my office, I hope, right? They can't become effective when you die, and I don't know what the situation's going to be when you die. I hope that there are 20 or 30 years before I see your family members coming into my office to probate your will. And in that 20 or 30 years, we don't know what will happen. So even the people right now who say, I have a will, pull it out and take a look at it. See what it does if something happens to one of your beneficiaries. See if it's protecting people. Take it to a lawyer to review. Many lawyers will do a free consultation, will review your documents to tell you if they're sufficient. Lots of detail is better than less detail. The more things we plan for, the fewer problems we're likely to have down the road.
And go to somebody who specializes in this.
Specializes.
Because attorneys are just like doctors now. It would make no sense to ask a podiatrist to do brain surgery for you. So why in the world would you go to your cousin's neighbor who does criminal defense? You know, so you want to make sure.
Yeah, it's cheap, but guess what? It's cheap to do it with us, too. It's not a very expensive.
People say, well, I can make my own will off the internet. Why should I pay you? Why should I pay you? I can make my own will. And I tell people, well, there's no law against you performing an appendectomy on yourself either. But why in the world would you? At least if you perform a surgery on yourself, you're only hurting yourself. If you make your own estate plan yourself, you hurt everybody you love because everybody you love thought that you'll tell them you have it together and then they don't realize that you don't. Then when after you're gone or when something happens, they realize that there's problems with the documents. They weren't made properly. They don't conform.
They're not worth the paper they're
written on. Those are life and death things. Mm-hmm. Whether or not somebody receives their inheritance, that can change completely people's lives. And you can save lives. And so that's why what Jenny says she cringes when somebody says, oh, I just do a simple will. It's like, ugh.
I cringe when I see it from an attorney who does not specialize in this or who does not work in this area. Every time I hear, we got one from LegalZoom, we bought a box for it, I have only in the time that I've been practicing seen one of those that actually ended up being valid. All the other ones that have been brought to me turned out to be technically deficient so that the people did wills, but they aren't valid wills under Texas law and can't be probated. And we ended up in an intestate succession, which may or may not do what the person wanted them to do. Especially where we have blended families, second marriages, kids from previous marriages, the answer is usually do not do what the person wanted it to do.
Yeah, our law is really fun. It assumes that if you have if you leave a wife and kids from a different marriage, that what you wanted was to leave your home to half to your spouse and half to your kids. Does that sound like a good plan?
Not really.
No.
Sometimes I have to sit across the table from a 78-year-old spouse who was a second marriage, and I'll have to say, you know, the home that you lived in for 40 years with your husband is now owned by your stepson who's in prison.
Yes.
And those are horrible situations to have to tell. That's what I'm talking about. This is life and death decisions. People get distraught at an elderly age. You can't go changing their living conditions without bringing great, great trauma into their lives. So these are very traumatizing things. And
when you're already suffering the loss of the spouse that you've been married to for 40 years.
As if
for
that those, wasn't enough.
For those people that ask me, you know, well, why don't I go to LegalZoom? I say, well, you come to us for peace of mind. I am your best shot at peace of mind. You know, I can't predict the future. My crystal ball is just as murky as yours. But what I can do is you know, use the tools that we have to plan for as many potential futures as possible.
Mm-hmm. I think there's something that's also lost in this conversation that I need to eliminate because it's ticking me off. It really is. And that's the art of human communication. I would rather deal with a lawyer face-to-face and
Correct.
Spell out everything in my will that I want to have covered when I die.
Correct.
Instead of going to some fly-by-night, and granted it's not fly-by-night, or at least not this year, LegalZoom.
It tells you right there on the top, it says, this is not legal advice. It says right there, if any lawyer connected their license or had any association with LegalZoom, they would be disbarred by the state of Texas.
I'm sure. And see, that's the other key to this whole conversation, especially for those of you who are streaming us anywhere in the world. We're talking about Texas law.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you're in Connecticut, if you're in Idaho,
Correct.
Or in Wyoming or Washington, wherever you are, check your state's laws because
That's
they
right.
will be different.
The big difference is
but
between
similar.
Community property states and non-community mm-hmm. property states. That's mm-hmm. the big kicker for people.
Well, that's
is
fun.
That if you have a marriage for 20 years in a non-community property state and then you have then you move to Texas and you've lived there for 10 years and then there's a divorce. I mean, there's all kinds of aspects in terms of how it affects your pensions. And
we plan for those things as well. You know, someone that lives in Texas, we have a lot of Fort Bliss people come to us, and we want to plan to go around the world to have very complex lives. And one of the best things that we can do is actually a trust in that situation. And the planning is even more imperative for those people that have changeable lives.
I do want to say two things about the interjurisdictional problems, though, the state-to-state problems.
Mm-hmm.
Every state has an agreement saying if your will is valid in the state in which you executed it, we will make it valid here. So if you do a will in Texas and then you move to another state, your will still be valid in that other state when you die. Though, if your circumstances change, it's always a good time to look at your will to see if you need to update it. And then the second one is, you're absolutely right. If you are elsewhere, you want to talk to an attorney where you live, let me plug the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys as a place to find someone who does this kind of law, who can give you good advice on how to plan for your specific needs.
We're going to have to leave it there, and then we'll pick it up the next time around. So obviously the invitation is on the table again. Mikasa Tsukasa, ladies, thank you so much for coming in and doing it again.
This is fun. Yeah.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
There's much more to this conversation of elder law that'll be posted up soon on our website under El Paso Primetime on KTEP.org. Thanks to our executive producer and editor, Deidre Westenhauser, for putting together this series. And thanks to you for spending a portion of your 4th of July for listening to this edition of El Paso Primetime.